jury find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty. As to the second count of the information, Richard McGinnis, we, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty. As to the third count of the information, unknown male, we, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty. As to the fourth count of the information, Anthony Huber, we, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty. As to the fifth count of the information, Gage Grosskreutz, we, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty.
Well, you just heard it. Acquitted on all charges. So, I'm not doing great. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm not doing great either. Let's be really, really clear here. This verdict is bad for the people of Wisconsin. That's why the trial is the people of Wisconsin versus Kyle Rittenhouse. They did not get justice done. This is bad because it is going to empower the conspiracy theorists who have been misrepresenting stuff over the past couple of weeks that we've been sort of dedicated to bringing down. And they'll be able to say, ha ha, you know, you guys on opening arguments, you were so confident.
Well, I'm glad I at least spared once. I should have emphasized it more, but I did say in yesterday's episode, I said, look, the jury may still find him innocent, but it won't have been the judge's fault.
That's right. And look, that makes this a harder question, right? Like it's an easy answer to say, oh yeah, the fix was in from the beginning about, and that's not the case. And so we have a harder question to deal with. It also means that I have spent, this time, obviously, you know, shocked and disappointed at the verdict. And I should add parenthetically, the other thing is, right, I mean, we already saw Mark McCloskey running for the Senate in Missouri. This is going to empower white vigilantes. And that sucks for humanity.
Couple obviously quick notes. This will be a cursing episode. This is a fast, rapid response. I don't know if I'll have time to edit, so we're probably doing it live. Needless to say,
this episode deserves a couple of fucks.
Yeah. So. If Rittenhouse were black, obviously he would have been, I don't even know what we'd be at this point. Like he would have been shot by the police, like in the middle of the thing, that's the first thing to say at the outset. This is only because he's a white kid that he got off here. There's no chance this would have happened to a black kid.
And that kind of discussion, right? The institutional and structural racism discussion is the kind we need to be having. It's the kind that needs to inform our discussion on the show. But again, it's a much harder and more nuanced issue. I've been focused on how did I get blindsided by this, right? Like I'm the legal expert on the show. What did I do wrong? What can I do better? And I think, there's sort of a couple of things here. The first is I have been searching for good faith interlocutors, right? People who predicted before the verdict came down that Rittenhouse was likely to be acquitted, but for reasons that weren't stupid and conspiratorial and whatever. I found article that was published in the Wisconsin State Journal. If you just search for the title, here's why Kyle Rittenhouse is likely to be acquitted and why the law on self-defense must change. And it's by Wisconsin law professor John Gross. I've reached out to him. I'd like to have him come on the show. There are a couple of really, really interesting things that I'm going to share from this article. But the biggest one, and it was one that if you look at my show notes, I had some notes on, but I downplayed and I shouldn't have downplayed it. And that is, in Wisconsin, once the other side, has raised self-defense, that then becomes an element. It's not treated like a normal affirmative defense. It becomes an element that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I should have emphasized
just that. In Wisconsin.
I don't know what other states.
Like, guess to rephrase the question, is this not what you would?
It was not what I expected. Yeah. No, it is not. It is not what I am used to seeing. And I wanted to make a point of that. I was prepared to make a much larger point of that until the prosecution won the provocation instruction. And then I got to tell you, I mean, I'm just guilty of tunnel vision on this, that I thought once the provocation instruction was given, I really couldn't see how you got to a self-defense verdict.
This is the incredibly confusing thing you just posted that...
it's incredibly confusing.
It's incredibly confusing. I think there's still a lot to say. Yeah,
that's instructive. I think that
overestimate the average Wisconsin juror's ability to understand what the hell's or to care about what's going on in that complicated instruction.
Okay, so and again, that's why I'm saying this is right. If I'm trying to do better, let me share. It's two paragraphs, each are a couple sentences long. You should also consider, and this is, by the way, this is on page five or six. This is the 5-6. This is the part that the jury first requested when they were sequestered, right? And so again, played into my beliefs about this trial. Mm-hmm. So the instruction says, you, the jurors, should also consider whether the defendant provoked the attack. A person who engages in unlawful conduct of a type likely to provoke others to attack and who does provoke an attack is not allowed to use or threaten force in self-defense against that attack. That's super duper clear. That's the rule. If you've
but then it doesn't go on like, oh, and so then if you do something else and there's like 18 different clauses after that.
There's only one exception, and I'll read it. And so you tell me how much this undermines it. And by the way, this is the end of the section, right? So that's paragraph one. Paragraph two is, however, if the attack which follows causes the person reasonably to believe that he is in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm, he may lawfully act in self-defense. But the person may not use or threaten force intended or likely to cause death unless he reasonably believes he has exhausted every other means to escape from or otherwise avoid death or great bodily harm.
And so I think the average juror looks at that and says, well, you know, the only evidence we had, I think you and I both know, and I think any reasonable person knows that Kyle Rittenhouse brought this on himself by having a gun pointing at people. Like, why would there have even been? We heard testimony that there were guns all over the place. Why did this happen to him? Like, I wonder what, you know, what it is. We have the grainy footage. The only thing, though, that they could provide was super grainy footage that he might have maybe pointed his gun to start all this. And then I think the jury looks at that, by the way, sees the sympathetic fucking, you know, doe-eyed white kid. And it's like, well, look at that. You know, he was running. Like we saw, they saw him running a lot of the time. Oh, he's running away. He's running away. You know, with the testimony of some of the people, you know, one of the victims was like, yeah, whatever he said, you know, I pointed my gun at him or whatever. You know, I think they put all that together and were like, well, you know, he was running. So it looks like he was trying to exhaust all other means. And, you know, he viewed his life in danger. So that's self-defense.
And I think we should have, I think I take 100% of the blame for this. I think I should have walked you through that as my level of confidence on yesterday's show. And we should have aired and presented the possibility of a defense verdict. And you should have, you know, had the opportunity. You didn't have the opportunity to push back at my interpretation of those provisions the way you did, because you deferred sort of to my like, hey, once they get the provocation instructions, those that like, to me, that counteracted the burden issue. In this case, right, because we're talking, as you put it, we're talking about what a jury believes, right? And it isn't that I, as a lawyer, have a better insight into what a jury, it's that I have a worse insight, right? Like a non-lawyer. True. Yeah. Like you would have had a much better insight into, hey, you know, like an average person could just kind of,
I really regret not making a bigger thing of it. I don't know. I don't know what to say. Cause I do think that this is a problem with expertise. You know, when you look at, and I think when anyone has expertise in an area, you know, when I look at a hockey game, I'm going to see things that you're not seeing. And I'm going to be like, yeah, obviously this guy over here should have done this over here. And I'm not going to be a good judge. If we had some weird thing where a jury of 12 random people from Wisconsin, well, actually Wisconsinites might know hockey pretty well, but if a jury of 12 random people had to evaluate a hockey play, you know, I might not be as good a judge as somebody who knows nothing about hockey, who's got to be like, well, but I'm looking at this with fresh eyes and not really seeing what you're seeing there. I think you saw the elements of that instruction. And we're like, oh, bingo, we got it, we nailed it. And I'm like, I guess I don't. And I wish I had spoken up more about that. And I'm sorry I didn't.
No. I think that, you know, we're trying to figure out, you know, how to best serve our listeners going forward. And again, this is a bad day for us, and it's a bad day for America. I want to emphasize, I stand by, I mean, every word we put out. And I think our coverage was and remains valuable. And if folks use this verdict to say, you know, see, this is proof that when the judge's phone played Lee Greenwood, you know,
it sucks because it's not worth it. You know, like it's not really worth being the person to push back on that right now. You know, like that's not a good use of our time. But I don't know, maybe a while from now, if this ever cools down, I would like to, you know, I'm tempted to ask someone, okay, what did the judge do that swayed the jury in this? And I think what you'll find, and I'm seeing this online, you'll find, and one of the reasons I'm so confident in your coverage of that is the first thing you'll find is, oh, well, he ruled that, you know, the victims couldn't be called victims. And that'll be what they'll say. And that's just not right. Like, that's just not, you know, like that's incorrect to say that was the judge, you know, handing the case over to Rittenhouse or whatever. You know, it's just not correct.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I want to jump ahead because I do want to make a technical correction to yesterday's episode, right? So episode 538 explains the whole victims, rioters, looters kind of thing. We then said, and I watched, you know, both closing arguments live, and I was listening for the word rioters, and I didn't hear it. It actually does come. Well, like I said, I heard it in the prosecution's close, but not in the defense close. Apparently, there must have been a colloquy off the record that said, you know, we're going to make brief reference as rioters. We're not going to use the word looters. That does not appear. And there is a very specific point that I'm going to point to in which the defense counsel makes points out that there is the word loot scrawled on the wall, and to point to the word loot on the wall but not use the word looter strongly suggests that, you know, that was the judge's ruling. There is no objection. Right. And there are objections in the middle of this closing argument, but there is no prosecution objection to the couple of times that he says, you know, there were rioters out there and the like. The real prejudice, and again, remember the way in which this was initially reported was, you know, incorrectly, was the prosecution said, hey, I'd like to call these victims when we talk about them. And the judge was like, nah, why don't you call them looters instead? Right. And none of that occurred during direct and cross-examination of the witnesses during the trial. Right. Like, this is, how is it characterized in a closing argument? Were there three instances of, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse is not that individual. The rioters, the demonstrators who turned into rioters, those are the individuals who bring us forth. Okay. So references like that, but I said, I want to, you know, sort of be 100% clear, particularly when we're talking about, you know, coming back to this in the future. If you look through the court transcript, you will find that word. It does not change in any way, you know, our analysis from 538, from episode 530. Yeah. People keep, yeah, right? People are like, why don't you have Nate Silver? And I'm like, Nate Silver doesn't talk to me anymore. I want to read a little bit from what John Gross wrote. And I'm curious your thoughts on this, Thomas.
All right.
That majority is high skeptical, if not outright dismissive, of Rittenhouse's claim that he acted in self-defense. But this view of the case against Rittenhouse is not based on what happened that night in Kenosha. It's based on what led Rittenhouse to be in Kenosha. It isn't that Rittenhouse didn't act in self-defense. It's that he shouldn't be allowed to claim he acted in self-defense. That belief is based on the fact that he was not legally allowed to possess the gun he used to kill two people and seriously injure a third. He was not allowed to be where he was in downtown Kenosha because of a curfew that was in place. And carrying an AR-15 assault rifle in public is an act that puts others in fear for their safety. Yeah. So attempts to disarm him are not a sufficient justification for the use of deadly force.
Yeah.
And then Gross says, and this is where I'd like to have him on the show, because I'd like to push back vis-a-vis provocation. He says, all of these beliefs are reasonable, but they do not reflect the current state of the law. Rittenhouse is not barred from claiming the privilege of self-defense because he illegally possessed a firearm. He is not barred from claiming the privilege of self-defense because he was violating a curfew. While many people feel that carrying an AR-15 assault rifle in public is dangerous and invites confrontation, Wisconsin is one of many open carry states where parading down a public street with a military-style assault rifle is permitted. If the jury acquits Rittenhouse, they will be doing what the law requires them to do. That should prompt us to ask why the law dictates this result and how the law might be changed to discourage people from resorting to deadly force, and if they do, to hold them more accountable.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty dead-on summary of what happened.
It does. It's hard to square with the jury instructions other than, you know, the Thomas Smith reading of, the jury, that it was kind of confusing and that the jury
in your mind, in your lawyerly mind, when you're thinking that he provoked the attacks, what are you basing that on?
I am basing that on him parading around with an AR-15, and then specifically, as is shown, and again, admittedly blurry and not zoomed in, but as is shown on the video, pointing the gun at Rosenbaum long before any of the alleged, you know, he's running at me, threatening me, trying to steal my gun stuff comes up, right? To me, parading around with a gun and then pointing a gun at somebody is illegal conduct that jeopardizes the use of violence. Clearly, the judge thought that that's a plausible interpretation because he allowed that instruction to go to the jury. And in particular, what we focused on and what I focused on, this is another error on my part, and I'm going to explain why, but it's an error of interpretation. I shouldn't say but. It is an error of interpretation. I focused on the trailing question, right? Like when we broke down on the Lamb episode, the very last question, good question, that Bingham, the prosecutor, asked of Rittenhouse was, okay, so you're telling us, why is it not dangerous if you have your gun pointed at Rosenbaum, but if he gets it and points it at you, you're afraid for your life?
Yeah, exactly.
And Rittenhouse had no answer to that.
I wish the jury would have taken that into account, because that is the fundamental place where you're like, I don't understand how you could rule this way.
And that featured in the prosecution's closing, but, and this is what I was going to say, my error was, is a confirmation bias. Like, to me, I looked at that, and when it came out, right, I ticked off the box, and I'm like, yep, that's right. They said the thing that they need to say in order to win this case. And that's not, that was, confirmation bias on my part, right? That was me looking for the prosecutor to say the thing I would have said. Now, look, I'm not a prosecutor, right? So it would be beyond the height of hubris to say, you know, if I'd gotten to give the closing argument, you know, mm-hmm. Rittenhouse would be behind bars. I'm in zero ways. That would be an appallingly
stupid thing.
Having said
that, I feel like the prosecutor did not do a great job.
Yeah, and I think we called that. And yeah. And again, this sort of goes back to a little bit of confirmation bias, right? In that if you and I both believe that it is very, very clear that Rittenhouse is guilty, at least guilty of the lesser included offenses, then, you know, we've sort of mentally patted ourselves on the back and said, okay, like, he's going to face some, I mean, I can tell you this is what I did, right? He's going to face some prison time. Whether he gets convicted on the most serious counts or not, they're all very serious. He's going to be spending some time in jail. And we did not prepare for, and we did not prepare our audience, is the real failure on my part here, for okay, yeah, but what if not, right?
Yeah.
And build that case. And the reason to build that case is because of what we're talking about, right? Like let's take some of the individual moment. And these are all things that we've said, but they're things that we should have put together. Yeah.
I hope if you're hearing this live, I hope I get a little sympathy for how hard it is to find a time to jump in here. Sandra truly is never done with a thought. There's never a time where he's like, and now I'm done. Talk, Thomas. So that's why I do tend to jump in. Apologies for that. It's very, very difficult to do correctly. But anyway, I did want to jump in at that thought and say that that's my regret in here now, because I think if you listen to the Lamb, you'll hear when I said, like, oh, I was really, Andrew talked me off a ledge. I said, you know, cause after Rittenhouse testified, I was like, oh, okay, we're fucked, you know? And it reminded me of the confirmation hearing, as people have pointed out, you know, it's that same thing. I mean, we have a lot of sympathy for what's the term that gets used? I'm blanking on it now, but, yeah, we have a lot of sympathy for a crying white victim or whatever.
Do you mean the Kavanaugh confirmation?
No, I mean, yeah. Himpathy. That's what it was. Himpathy is the,
I like that.
The term. Yeah. I think it was anyway, I have a hard time recalling these facts off the top of my head, but, anyway, I was very worried. And what I wish I had called out more in our later coverage. And I think I was, perhaps complacent in my Negatron, my duties as a Negatron, you know, like you did kind of convince me. And I felt really confident based on your confidence a little bit, not to put all the blame on you. I should have pushed back because I worried when we talked about, you know, him having brought this upon himself, I worried that that all came down to the grainy footage of him maybe pointing a gun. And that is a worry that I should have voiced more of, like, hey, does this all kind of collapse if the jury's like, I don't really see him pointing his gun at all. You know, like, does this all basically fall apart? And that was way too big of a weakness for this all to sit on for us to be at all confident in a guilty verdict, I think.
Well, okay. But now let me push back at you a little bit. That is relevant, I think, to the top line offenses, right? But remember, we have all of the lesser included offenses, right? So let me pull up the jury instructions. Let's take kind of one of the middle ones, right? So Gage Grosskreutz at one point, you know, had the gun. So let's eliminate count five, right? Let's say, for example, they threw that all out in the wash.
Which, as you pointed out a second ago, doesn't make any fucking sense because, you know, Rittenhouse had a gun. They both have a gun. Who gets to claim self-defense? I guess the lesson is shoot first. Be the one who killed the other guy because then you're like, well, I was afraid for my life. And then the other person doesn't ever get to say the same thing because they're dead. Right? I mean, is that... am I wrong, Andrew?
How is this supposed to work? You do not appear to be wrong in the context of this. I mean, you know... How do we deal with, for example, counts 2 and 3, right? Which is recklessly endangering the safety of Richard McGinnis. That's the Daily Caller reporter that is following Rittenhouse around, right? And we've seen that. What is defined as the state's... So let me read this to you, okay? So statutory definition of the crime. First degree recklessly endangering safety, as defined in the Criminal Code of Wisconsin, is committed by one who recklessly endangers the safety of another human being under circumstances that show utter disregard for human life. State's burden of proof. Before you may find the defendant guilty of first degree recklessly endangering safety, the state must prove by evidence which satisfies you beyond a reasonable doubt that the following three elements were present. One, the defendant endangered the safety of another human being. Well, obviously, he fired an AR-15 in the direction of a Daily Caller reporter. Okay. Two, the defendant endangered the safety of another by criminally reckless conduct. Criminally reckless conduct means the conduct created a risk of death or great bodily harm to another person, and the risk of death or great bodily harm was unreasonable and substantial, and the defendant was aware that his conduct created the unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. Great bodily harm, we don't need that. That's not an issue. It is defined in there. Then it says, three, the circumstances of the defendant's conduct showed utter disregard for human life. In determining whether the defendant showed utter disregard for human life, consider these factors: what the defendant was doing, why the defendant was engaged in the conduct, how dangerous the conduct was, how obvious the danger was, whether the conduct showed any regard for life, and all other facts and circumstances related to the conduct. And then there's a special rule with respect to the reporter, right? Which says, there is evidence in this case that the defendant was acting in self-defense as to Joseph Rosenbaum. The fact that the law may allow the defendant to use force in self-defense as to Joseph Rosenbaum does not necessarily mean that recklessly endangering the safety of Richard McGinnis was lawful. Though you must consider the law of self-defense in deciding whether the defendant's conduct as to Richard McGinnis was criminally reckless conduct, which showed utter disregard for human life, but the defendant does not have a privilege of self-defense as to Richard McGinnis, period. Right? So in other words, this is built for precisely the scenario. Okay, you bailed on count number one. That's what we went through. You didn't buy Andrew's argument on the provocation. How in the hell do you not convict with respect to the obvious kid, the guy who was, you know, quote unquote, on your side? I mean, I just read to you what was read to the jury. Did I misestimate that one too?
Apparently. I mean, again, this all came down. Look, is it fair to say, Andrew, that it's possible that none of this analysis matters if voir dire already decides the thing? Like, is it possible that if you get the right jury, which I think in a case like this in this country, and especially in maybe in Wisconsin, odds are decent that you get a jury that just wasn't going to convict him? You know, I mean, this was, by the way, this was a unanimous verdict. It took, we didn't talk about this much, but it did take a lot longer than people were thinking. So maybe
can we sidebar that a little bit?
Yeah.
So let's talk about that, because we retweeted out occurred rather unfortunately, sorry Ben, about 10 minutes before the verdict came down. But a post from our buddy Ben Young saying, you know, the fact that this has gone into day four of deliberations has got to be making the defense nervous. And he is 100% correct.
The defense attorney even said that, I think, in the after the fact.
Good. I'm glad. And I just want, because, you know, people were, you know, dunking on us and dunking on Ben. And it was just like, no, he's 100% correct in that, because think about how the dynamics unfold, right? Like, if you're correct that, you know, this was all settled kind of at voir dire, and, you know, they just sort of believed
Rittenhouse. Well, hold on. I didn't finish. I think
I'm sorry.
The facts would be consistent with one holdout as well. You know, like maybe, you know, or one or two holdout, who knows? Like, a majority of the jury that's like, look, this is self-defense. You know, these people had it coming. Yeah, who knows? Like, fucking who knows what kind of Trumpers are in that jury? You know, I mean, I don't know what. So this also would be consistent with, you know, there is one or two sane people on the jury and they tried for 4 or 5 days or whatever it is, and then ultimately lost.
So here's why that's a hard. I'm glad we're going through all this. Maybe we should have done this on Thursday. Although again, you know, now we're
we were in like hour five of
a 6 hour show. Right,
yeah. Content. Yeah.
It's hard to predict what's going to be relevant. So I'm really glad we're doing this and glad we're doing a follow-up episode. But let's walk through that. If you believe in good conscience, that he is guilty and that it is, you know, monstrous to let him walk. Wisconsin is a jury unanimity again, state.
When I say holdout, it doesn't mean that one person is like death to Rittenhouse. It could be one person is just, you know, hesitant on some of the stuff.
Well, that's true. So let's get to that. This is now the tree has branched a lot, but let's first deal with the idea of there's one to two holdouts who, you know, are pretty strong in their beliefs. Typically we've talked about this before. If that is sort of motivated by conscience, if that is a strongly held belief, then you know you can just hold out and hang the jury, right? Yeah. And again, hanging the jury, way better outcome.
Way better than acquittal.
Right. Way better than acquittal. And by the way, we come back to this sidebar, like the fact that the defense moved for mistrial without prejudice, right? It indicates, you know, nobody thought that this was
too late to
bag.
Take that bargain, by the way, prosecution. Yeah, no, I did actually compress the file. Mistrial, redo.
Yeah. They did not have nearly enough defense prep. Yeah. Number one, holding out is always an option if you're on a jury unanimity state. And usually what happens in that case, I was preparing for us to discuss this, we've talked about this on the show, is Monday, right? If there'd been no verdict today, and then, you know, depending on whether the jurors were sent home or sequestered for the weekend, what you would have is, right, the judge would come back with an Allen charge. And every state has a version of that. That's the federal name.
Yeah, we discussed this a little lecture, like a pep talk.
Yeah, it is a judge, it is a
try harder.
I understand that you are remain hopelessly divided, without prejudice to where you are. You know, consider if you are in the minority, if your view after, you know, 5 days of argument has been insufficient to convince the supermajority of your colleagues on this jury that, you know, maybe you're not so correct after all, right? That's basically what it says. And then it reaffirms your right to hold out. So the first thing we can say is there was nobody on this jury who felt like holding out past, you know, the beginning of day four. The second thing we can say is
the weekend looming.
I really, really don't want to believe it was, I would hold out, but not if it cost me my weekend.
Who knows? Don't let me distract you. Continue with what you were going to say.
And again, you jump in anytime you want. You know, that's always been our rule, Thomas. I will say, I guess I have more faith in juries than
I think
that,
that's the key. And honestly, I think maybe you have a little too much faith in juries. That might be the key component here. I don't think you're really wrong on any of the elements of the legal analysis. I think could it really be as simple as you have a little too much faith in juries?
Could be. So now, you know, let's also, the other thing that sort of gives you confidence in having some kind of mixed outcome, if not, you know, outright conviction on the on at least one of the top line counts, is that 3.5 days, right? Like, what happened in that jury box, you know, in the privacy of their deliberations. It's again, 3.5 days is very consistent with carefully parsing your instructions as to five different counts, some of which have lesser included offenses, right? And like ticking boxes and following a flow chart and being like, oh, well, we don't get to here because of here. We do get to here because of here, right? Which again is predicting a jury that behaves more in the way that I was predicting and less in the way that you were predicting, right? If it is just, nope, we saw Rittenhouse on the stand and we believe him. And, you know, we kind of have a general feeling of dangerous night, and you know, he did nothing that was, you know, that was outside the bounds of self-defense. In that case, it seems like it's hard to come up with why that would take 3.5 days, right? Like that would take 3.5 minutes.
It could be the holdout. I think we can both agree that the most reasonable interpretation of it taking this long is at least somebody on the jury needed convincing. And I think that it could be possible that not that they were some like Rittenhouse must burn for what he did juror, because I think they would have held out further and caused a hung jury. It could be maybe they were all pretty sympathetic, but, you know, some number of them are like, yeah, but what about these lesser included? Maybe we should do that. And then, you know, they were eventually talked out of that somehow.
Yeah. Right now, that seems like sort of the most plausible course of action. So, but again,
I wonder if I honestly just more American psychology, because our system does come down to 12 people who, as the old joke goes, were too dumb to get out of jury duty. There wasn't a sympathetic enough victim, perhaps, you know, like, honestly, like if one of the victims had been like a young white girl, like, who knows, like, honestly, that maybe then you'd be convicted. It shouldn't make any difference by the letter of the law, but like psychologically, I think we find that tends to be the case in outcomes.
So what that suggests is two things, and this becomes a big ask, right? It suggests that, protests are about to become a lot more dangerous in this country because a lot more people are going to be, they were already, we have seen, we have seen those dynamics. We watched what happened under Trump. We watched, literal black shirts, body slamming journalists with their Lexan riot shields. Thankfully, we've ended that practice, but that has not ended the practice of state and local law enforcement coming down on protesters. So protesting already dangerous, about to become more so. And your point is, and if we have more allyship at those protests, that may change the dynamic. And that's a hard thing. Like I said at the beginning, that's a big ask. But this is part of what we can do, to help, our brothers, sisters, siblings, be safe. And that is, you know, don't allow it where if you go out there with your AR-15, you know, if you don't allow it where if some asshole goes out armed, looking to pick a fight, the odds are 99-1 that his victims are going to be black. Stand there in solidarity, and that's a hard ask.
None of the victims were black in this case, right? I mean,
I'm just thinking in terms
just
of
hypothetically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I see a lot of people out there talking about like, well, I guess we all have to carry guns. We got to bring guns out there. And like, I get the sentiment, but I'm sure shit not doing that. I don't think that that's gonna bring good outcomes, but I understand the impulse. Like maybe people will feel like they need to defend themselves now. I get it. I totally get it. Saying me personally, I'm not going to do that because I don't want to increase the chances of somebody getting killed.
Yeah, I don't either. All the statistics show that. I mean, everything. But let's go back to Gross's article too, John, to Professor John Gross's article that I was reading from. One of the disconnects that you and I may likely have from that Wisconsin jury is our view that walking around with an AR-15 strapped to your chest is provoking behavior, right? Is provocative behavior. If this is a, you know, if this is a hunting culture, and as Gross points out, you know, it's an open carry, dress like a Marine state. The more, I guess my point there is, the more we normalize that, the less people will draw that inference. And so, you know, of the many reasons why I guess we on the left have to start carrying guns is a super bad idea, and it's not one I'm going to use, is it undercuts the inference that we're trying to draw here, right? The idea that, like, we should strongly demarcate, like, did you go into a situation intending to use force, or did you go into a situation intending to be helpful? You know, obviously, you know, Rittenhouse was able successfully to blur that line to this jury, but let's not make it easier for the next one to do that. I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah. And there's two conflicting things here that, I just want to, I guess, explore for a second. And then there's other things that you wanted to get to that we should get to. But on one hand, obviously this fucking sucks and it's really bad for our country, as we've said, and Rittenhouse was guilty. And this is a terrible injustice. It's going to be bad for everybody. But on the other hand, what happened was 12 fucking people in Wisconsin said a thing. And it's tough. Like, I get both sides, because I see a lot of posts that are like, well, country's over, you know, like, well, that system doesn't work, country's over, da da da. And I 100% understand the sentiment, and I agree with a lot of that. But then on the other hand, if you look at it from another way, it's like, well, if 12 people in Wisconsin said anything, I wouldn't give that much of a shit about it. You know, it's sort of this contradiction of our system where all of a sudden, same way with the Electoral College, like, it just prioritizes certain people. And it puts us in these situations where, like, on one hand, you can look at it and say, this is one jury that said a thing. Like, there's no reason that we all should be like, well, the country's over because one jury of 12 people said a thing. But at the same time, I get it, because, you know, like, if that's going to become a new norm, if that's going to inform other cases around the country, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much Wisconsin is unique. And if this had happened in another state with slightly different laws, slightly different burden shifting or whatever, like, maybe it would have gone the other way. I don't have any answers. I just wanted to kind of put voice to that weird contradiction where it's somehow both shouldn't be very significant, but also is incredibly significant.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know that I have anything to add to that. I mean,
to some of the questions? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Let's get to some of the questions. But I guess I just sort of want to wrap all of that up with, you know, some folks have said, you know, I am too, you know, and I trust too much in the process, and that may be a fair criticism, but it's a fair criticism in the sense that I think the underlying problems with the process are that you know, the structural racism that undergirds the process. So, for example, if this were a black defendant, he almost certainly would have been held and not released on bail, certainly not across state lines. And the statistics back that up. So now if you take Rittenhouse and instead of him being in a suit, he's in an orange jumper and chained up at the table.
Yeah.
It is impossible to describe the difference in the optics because of that. Is that, where does that blame go? Can you put that blame on the, judge? But you also should put that blame on a system that institutionally, systematically results in those kinds of disparities. So I have never meant to say that I thought the system was perfect, just that it's important for us to identify kind of where the blame goes. So, you know, this is typical of a couple of sort of the negative responses that we got was, you know, in describing the jury instructions, you know, there was and again, I'm paraphrasing a comment, but like, but you know, they don't really care about the process and never have, and you shouldn't have had those expectations. Right. And my response back was, who's the they? Right. And when you think about who is the they, like, I think this is a really good, like, I think this case serves to illustrate the difference between there being a simplistic individual bad actor, right? The judge is in the pocket of the defense. Versus, you know, the they is us, right? Like the they is amorphous. The they is, you know, the influence of, you know, hundreds of years layered on top of each other, and that's a harder answer. So, you know, it obviously we're doing a lot of thinking about this, and so, you know, this makes it. Makes the questions harder, not easier, I guess. So let's deal with some questions.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are wondering, you know, what happens next. People are asking, so I'll just pose the questions. We might already know the answers to these, but just for the sake of saying them, what about federal charges? Anything?
So you could concoct is the wrong. Let me not use a word that loaded. Absolutely, it is plausible to bring federal charges in a case where somebody crosses state lines with a firearm. And I'm going to lump into that the question of, like, isn't it Biden's DOJ's fault for, you know, not assuming control of this from the start and prosecuting him and prosecuting Rittenhouse in federal court? And I think that that is the worst kind of backseat driving right now, right? Like, this is the state charges were much easier. We just read you the one with respect to McGinnis, the Daily Caller reporter, right? Like, that is a knockdown 100%. Like, obviously that charge was proven at trial. And so, you know, in a situation like that with overlapping jurisdiction where you have some federal offenses that are going to be harder to prove because you're going to have to prove that the intent began in Illinois and was carried over into Wisconsin. And the defense argument, I can tell to you right now, like I would, you know, I can make that argument. But Rittenhouse didn't buy the gun in Illinois.
Yeah.
Right. He didn't get the gun until he got into Wisconsin. How could he have possibly, you know, and then now you're left in a like litigating out, you know, what was Kyle Rittenhouse thinking when he left Aurora, Illinois, which, you know, you don't want to do that as a prosecutor. So I think it was entirely appropriate for the feds to defer to the state in this instance. And I think having failed to secure a conviction on lower hanging fruit without, you know, sort of obvious incompetence. We've talked about it. Like, I think this prosecutor was a B minus, right? Like, he did some good stuff. He did some bad stuff. He was, and he's fine, right? Like, he wasn't great.
Yeah.
But you know, he wasn't Mr. Magoo. Well, we talked about like the severe ethical lapse.
Yeah, was not great.
That was not great. So you can score him lower if you want, but I don't think that the DOJ is going to look at this and go, we obviously have to get involved. So I think there will not be federal charges because of what happened here.
All right. Well, on to the civil. I mean, I'm sure we all have in mind the OJ case. You know, yep. Another time where definitely the wrong outcome was reached. And then in the civil case, things went a different way. What do you think?
I think there absolutely will be civil charges against Rittenhouse. The thing that's different here and more frustrating is Rittenhouse is already hooked up with the right-wing grift machine. And when that happens, he will 100% crowdsource fundraise off of it. And whether they will even be worse off as a result, I don't know. Yeah. That is not to to suggest. Well, I mean,
the victims' families would still get money, though.
Correct. I mean,
they would still get recompense.
They 100% will and should bring those civil cases.
Yeah.
And the O.J. Simpson model is the right model. It is just frustrating to me to sort of watch the slow motion unfolding of, I mean, you know, we were joking about it because we expected Rittenhouse to be in jail. But, you know, I mean, that this Matt Gaetz has already offered him a congressional internship. And, you know, the right wing, I'll put it this way. Mark Furman has a talk show on the Fox whatever Fox's version of Apple TV Plus is, right? They've got a payroll, a private streaming service that's full of like the worst kinds of garbage. I know this because the Knowledge Fight guys subscribe to it to get some Alex Jones stuff, right? And I listened with sputtering outrage of all of us to Dan talking about how Mark Furman, you know, the racist detective from the O.J. Simpson trial, has had like 8 years of basically like his version of opening arguments over on this Fox News, you know, paper. So, yeah. And he's horrible. He's not, I mean, he's there because he's a horrible human being. Rittenhouse is going to get one of those deals yesterday. He's going to be on the gravy train and that's sad. And there was no chance to, you know, despite what, non tears were squeezed out at this trial. We know exactly what, you know, what his position is going to be, you know, what his public persona is going to be. And that's awful and terrifying. So, let's hope the victims are able to extract as much of that money as possible. Yeah.
This may take more prep, but I think the questions that I have and that people might have, and feel free to punt for later, but how will, civil suits look different? What will be, I guess, the torts? What will be the things they're suing for? You know, wrongful death, whatever things. And then, will there be a difference in terms of what kind of evidence you can get in civil cases?
Yep. The answer is yes on both of those, and it probably does deserve, you know, when those civil suits are filed, we will take a look. Your legal training has served you well. The top line tort is going to be a tort of wrongful death. And the burden of proving wrongful death is just preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not. The defense of self-defense will be a true affirmative defense in that civil case. So in other words, the burden will be for Rittenhouse to prove more likely than not that he acted in self-defense, as opposed to the state having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did not act in self-defense. It is just...
Even though it's the same state?
I know. Okay. And how does that affect the evidence? It absolutely affects the evidence on things like judgment calls, right? Like, so we've talked about, you know, what about some of these prior bad acts, right? Like, what about... The evidence of, you know, Rittenhouse from August saying, yep, you know, I kill you at the car dealership, right? You can see, judge, right? Like, and the question is probative value versus prejudice. Judges tend to weight the potential prejudice higher when the adverse outcome of that prejudice is we deprive you of your liberty in a way, yeah, that is, you know, unrecompensable versus money, right? Well, it's money. Money is money, right? So absolutely. But in both of those cases, you have the opportunity for evidence that was excluded here to be allowed in a subsequent civil trial. And I would expect that would be the case. That also sometimes happens in mistrials too, right? Like, remember, if it's a judgment call, we talked about this last came up, for example, in the Bill Cosby case, right? Like, there was a mistrial the first time, they only allowed one, former victim to attest as to, the Quaaludes, behavior. And then in the retrial, They allowed multiple women, right? So same exact cause of action, but where it is up to the discretion of the judge to evaluate prejudice versus probative, you know, different judges can come to different conclusions. So I would suspect that in a civil suit, you would see some of the things that people have said, hey, why didn't this get in this trial?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you think there's a way the prosecution could have, we've already talked about this, but it blows my mind that you couldn't get in the evidence of him threatening to essentially shoot somebody if he had a gun. It just seems like it really speaks to what his mental state might have been when he actually had the gun. Do you think the prosecutor could have gotten that in somehow, or was that just, I don't know, the way the system works, it's too prejudicial or whatever?
So to me, the way in which, when I think about evidence that has been excluded on the basis of prejudice, or I think about hearsay, right? Like that the judge has excluded because I'm not going to allow the jury to evaluate the truth or falsity of that proposition. Logically, as a lawyer, your thought process, if you want to try and get it in, will go to impeachment, right? We'll go to saying, okay, well, now what I want to do is, I want to have this person on the stand say something that is inconsistent with this piece of evidence. And then I can say, oh, I'm not offering this evidence for the truth or falsity of what it contains, but I'm offering it to impeach what he just said, right? So how would you do that? You would maybe not ask the questions about like playing Call of Duty and crap like that.
Yeah.
And instead probe down on, you said you came here to defend businesses. Tell me what you mean by defending businesses. You understand, don't you, that you may not use self-defense in place of a business, right? But you think it's okay to use deadly force to protect a business, don't you, right? Like, and maybe you can evoke an answer that says no, and then you'd be like, and you've always thought, right? Have you ever thought that it was appropriate to use self-defense to defend a building? That's going to get an objection. You're probably not going to get an answer. But, you know, something like that where you try and goad him into saying, like, no, I would only ever, you know, want to use self-defense to defend me. Like, I would never want to use self-defense to defend property. And then you would say, okay, sidebar, Your Honor. I want to impeach with, I know you kept this evidence out, but you just heard him testify that he would never use deadly force to defend a building. And I got evidence of him using deadly force to defend property. Yeah. So,
and most importantly, you would ask fucking permission first instead of trying to sneak it in.
Yeah.
So maybe that would have worked.
Defensively bad. I mean, and who knows, right? you may have had more success with that. You couldn't have had less. So
yeah,
true. That's the way to think.
All right, we're almost up on time. What did we forget in this time that? What did we not get to that you meant to get to in all this?
The question of can the prosecution appeal? And the answer is that the prosecution can appeal on any of their procedural objections, right? For evidence that was excluded. But I would say, practically speaking, I would be surprised if the state decided
It's hypothetically possible to get another trial or something if you're the prosecution?
It absolutely is, right? Like, and wow. It that does not violate double jeopardy on appeal, because what happens is that first trial is vacated. The idea is, no, the prosecution should have been able to introduce evidence that X, the judge incorrectly excluded it, and then, you know, the solution is you try again.
How often does that happen? I've never heard of that.
Almost never.
Okay. So not worth putting a lot of hope into that.
Yeah. And it would not happen in this case.
Yeah. Because there wasn't anything egregious enough, in your opinion.
No. And again, those... typically where you see where you see an appeal is if there has been like a very, very contentious suppression ruling, for example. You know, I am going to keep out his confession because I don't believe, you know, that was voluntarily given. It was pressured. And then you would say, yeah, but the legal standards were met here. And the judge says, well, you know, you're free to argue that on appeal.
All right. Well, this sucks. I think you and I have a lot that we're considering to improve our coverage going forward. I think if I had to do over again, I would have just probably emphasized some more doubts, but it doesn't change the legal analysis. I still think it's valuable what we're doing here, you know, and I think we also will have to trust in the intelligence of our audience, which I think we do. You know, we have a very smart audience, and I think that our audience is smart enough to know that the evidence that the judge wasn't necessarily biased, and the point you make about debunking those myths is not contradicted by the jury deciding something that we disagree with. You know, like I think people can still disagree. Like, people are free to disagree and say, like, oh no, I think the judge was a little bit biased in the following ways, but the jury deciding this really doesn't put, and it really doesn't answer the question one way or the other. I mean, solid evidence would have been had we gotten a conviction and the judge had been like, yeah, but he's a good kid, so no time or something. I mean, yeah, that would have been solid evidence.
Absolutely. And I was prepared to go I had pulled all sorts of law review articles regarding sentencing in Wisconsin, because mm-hmm. Wisconsin, it uses a matrix, but they do not use the matrix for homicide cases. And so as it turns out, So when it says, you know, of a class B misdemeanor, you may be sentenced up to 60 years in jail, right? Like, does that mean the judge can say, okay, well, I'm going to sentence you to probation? And in fact it does, but as a matter of practice, right? And this is in, my show notes from the last episode. We never talked about this at all, but, and I forget the name of the law review article. I looked at, a couple of things written by somebody who appears to be, you know, the most prominent sentencing expert in Wisconsin, in Wisconsin state laws. And basically, he talked about how there is this, even though the judges have wide discretion, they generally trend towards the top of the range because there is this perception that exactly the one that I just played with, which is, if you are sentenced to a crime that says, if you're convicted of a crime that says you may be sentenced up to 60 years in prison, and the judge is like, well, 3 is up to 60, right? Like, that feels ridiculous, right? Like, that feels like you have deliberately picked, you know, a tiny little number. And so the sentences tend to be at the top of the range. So yeah, I thought we were going to be litigating this judge from the perspective of, you know, during the sentencing phase. We're not going to have an opportunity to do that. And obviously that's disappointing.
All right. Well, I hope this was helpful to people. I hope it was useful. I know we're introspecting right now. And I think this will inform coverage going forward. But again, I mean, I think it would have just allowed more caveats, you know. It would have just been like, also, the jury could just go the wrong way, which I did say, but I didn't emphasize enough, I don't think.
Yeah, and again, I don't think it would have materially changed how people reacted to our episode, because we did a wrap up and you said, you know, all right, bottom line. And if we had said, okay, but you know, here are the ways in which the jury could acquit, you know, and you could get an entire defense verdict. If you'd asked me at the end, how confident are you that the jury will convict? I would have read you what I just did here and said, okay, you tell me how the jury is not going to convict on...
Man, I wish I had done that.
endangering of safety towards, you know, towards the Daily Caller reporter. Like, there's just nothing in the facts. There's nothing that was presented on the stand that would have... said he did not at least, and that's a class F misdemeanor with a 12 and a half years maximum time in prison, right? And again, you know, super easy now to say, You know, I'd take 12 and a half years in prison over nothing.
Yeah.
But I would have right? Like if that would have been the verdict that came back, right? Like not guilty on 4 out of 5 counts, guilty first degree, reckless endangering the safety of others with respect to the Daily Caller reporter. I would have said, a little bit surprising, but you know, at least this is somebody who's going to face criminal punishment for criminal behavior instead of, you know, getting what's going to happen, which is getting rewarded for criminal behavior. So.
All right. Any other closing thoughts or are we going to call it here?
You know, I all I can say is I hope that the disconnect between our evaluation and the results does not let anybody undermine or obscure what I think was still, you know, really, really good work in piecing through how we got to the conclusion of the trial, right? And I think all of the like conspiracy theory nonsense, right? Like, you know, just ask somebody like, you really think the jury decided the way they did because 8 seconds of Lee Greenwood's song played, you know, when the judge's phone rang? I mean, come on. I was going to say that. Well, oh, we are on it.
Yeah.
On a non-censored. Next time I'll say, come the fuck on. But
yeah, good thing you didn't say that here.
Yeah, I would not want to do that now.
All right, listeners. As I said, we have no choice but to trust in the intelligence of our listeners, and I do trust in the intelligence of our listeners because I think this is an intelligent show, and I think all this information can still be useful, and our episodes and our coverage, I think, were very useful, and I learned a ton, even if ultimately, we were too confident in a guilty verdict, but thanks for listening. Thanks so much for, thanks for listening and engaging with us. And we're going to continue being really fucking depressed today about this. And we'll see you for Tuesday's episode, which was recorded before this. So just FYI.
Yeah.